you. I will now turn the call over to Ms. Samantha Ortega. Please go ahead.
Hello, and welcome to today's Kaiser Family Foundation web briefing to highlight key findings from our newly released report, Modern Era Medicaid, findings from a 50-state survey of eligibility, enrollment, renewal, and cost-sharing policies as of January 2015. Thank you all so much for joining us today. My name is Samantha Ortega with the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured, and we look forward to sharing findings from this 13th annual survey, which was conducted by the Kaiser Family Foundation's Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured and the Georgetown University's Center for Children and Families. Today, we are just 1 year into implementation of key ACA provisions that have contributed to significant transformation of Medicaid by expanding coverage and accelerating state efforts to provide a streamlined, modernized enrollment experience for individuals. These new survey findings provide a comprehensive look at states' Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance Program eligibility, enrollment, renewal, and cost-sharing policies 1 year into the post-ACA era, identifying key state advancements towards fulfilling the ACA's vision, as well as areas of continuing work. We will begin today's briefing with a presentation of the survey's key findings from two of the report's co-authors, Jessica Stevens, Senior Policy Analyst with the Foundation's Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured, and Tricia Brooks, Senior Fellow with the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families. We will then hear perspectives on the survey findings from a really great panel of federal and state officials who we are so excited to have join us today. They include Vicki Wachino, Deputy Director of the Center for Medicaid and CHIP Services at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, Judith Arnold, Director, Division of Eligibility and Marketplace Integration, the New York State Department of Health, Rex Plouffe, Portfolio Manager, the Governor's Office of Health Transformation in Ohio, and finally, Linda Nablow, Chief Deputy Director, the Virginia Department of Medical Assistance Services. Following their remarks, we will then open the discussion up for a question and answer period. I will note that the presentation today will touch on the survey findings at a high level. I would encourage you to take a look at the full report for more details, including state-based tables, which is now available on our website at kfs.org. Before we turn to the key findings, I want to acknowledge the many, many people who made this survey happen, as it truly is a team effort. First, I want to recognize all the other report co-authors, and in addition to Jessica Stevens and Tricia Brooks, who you will be hearing from today. They include Alexandra Gates with the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured, and Joe Tushner with the Georgetown University for Center for Children and Families. I also want to thank the many state officials who participated in this survey and generously shared their time and expertise with us amid their extremely busy schedules. This survey simply would not be possible without them, and we truly appreciate their assistance with this work. Finally, a few housekeeping items before I turn this over to Jessica and Tricia. First, slides and a recording of this webinar will be available after the event on our website at kfs.org. We will hold the question and answer session after all panelists have provided their remarks, but you should feel free to submit questions as we proceed. We have a lot of folks listening in today, so we will be unlikely to get through all the questions, but we'll do our best to get through as many as possible. Now, to get started, let's turn it over to Jessica Stevens with the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured, and Tricia Brooks with the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families to tell us more about the key findings from the survey.
Thanks, Samantha. I will jump right in to provide a brief overview of the survey and discuss some of the findings related to Medicaid and CHIP eligibility across states, and then turn it over to Tricia to provide more detail on enrollment and renewal processes and cost-sharing requirements that we document in the report. So as Samantha mentioned, this is our 13th annual survey report on Medicaid and CHIP policies in all 50 states and D.C., and as in previous years, it's based on telephone interviews with Medicaid and CHIP program administrators. The report covers policies in place as of January 1st, 2015, for children, pregnant women, parents, and other non-disabled adults. This includes policies related to eligibility, enrollment and renewal processes, systems, and premium and cost-sharing requirements across states. As a whole, it provides a snapshot of state Medicaid and CHIP policies in place 1 year after key Medicaid provisions of the Affordable Care Act took effect. So, starting with eligibility for adults, over half of states, specifically 29, which are shown in the darkest blue on this map, extend Medicaid eligibility for parents to at least 138% of the federal poverty level, the new ACA minimum threshold under the expansion. This is as of January 2015. And that's about $27,000 for a parent and a family of three. The other 22 states shown in the lightest and medium blue here are all states that have not adopted the Medicaid expansion, and in most of them, eligibility limits for parents are much lower, below half of the federal poverty level. I'll talk more about eligibility levels for parents in non-expansion states in a moment, but first, switching to talk about childless adults. As is the case for parents, eligibility for childless adults is at or above, or eligibility levels for childless adults are at or above 138% of poverty in the 28 states, including D.C., that have adopted the Medicaid expansion as of January 2015. And those are the states that are shaded in the darkest blue on this map. None of the 23 remaining non-expansion states, except Wisconsin, provide full Medicaid coverage to childless adults as of January 2015. In Wisconsin, Medicaid eligibility extends to adults with incomes up to the poverty level, so that's still below the Medicaid expansion limit of 138% SPL. As one might expect, median Medicaid eligibility levels for adults have increased compared to pre-ACA levels in states that adopted the Medicaid expansion. This is especially true for childless adults who were ineligible for Medicaid in most states prior to the ACA. So looking here, you see that in the 28 states that are adopting the Medicaid expansion, the Medicaid median Medicaid eligibility limit for parents increased from 106% of the federal poverty level to 138% of the federal poverty level as of January 2015. For childless adults, the median eligibility limit in the expansion states increased from 0 to 138% SPL. However, eligibility for adults remains limited in states that are not adopting the Medicaid expansion at this time. And looking at the first set of bars on the left in this slide, you see that 19 of the 23 non-expansion states limit Medicaid eligibility to parents with incomes below the poverty level. And as I alluded to before, 14 states limit Medicaid eligibility to parents below half of the federal poverty level as of January 2015. That's a little less than $10,000 per year for a parent in a family of three. On the right side of the slide, you see again that childless adults remain ineligible for full Medicaid in all 23 non-expansion states except Wisconsin, where the income eligibility limit for adults is 100% of the SPL. Now, looking at eligibility across groups, we find that even with the expansion, Medicaid and CHIP eligibility levels for children and pregnant women remain higher than those for adults. Nationally, the median income eligibility limits for children and pregnant women are 255% SPL and 205% SPL, respectively, compared to 138% for parents and other adults. These differences are even starker in non-expansion states, shown in the lighter blue bars here. Across those 23 states that are not adopting the Medicaid expansion at this time, the median Medicaid eligibility limits are 0% for childless adults, 45% for parents, compared to more than 200% of the federal poverty levels for both children and pregnant women. Now, separate from the eligibility levels themselves, states have adopted a number of options to increase access to Medicaid and CHIP coverage for children and pregnant women, and these are documented in the report. But to give you a snapshot, for children, nearly two-thirds of states, 33, now have no waiting period for CHIP, meaning that there's no specified period of time that a child has to be without group coverage before enrolling in the program. Secondly, over half of states have eliminated the five-year waiting period required for lawfully residing immigrant children to enroll in Medicaid or CHIP. Also, under the ACA, all states must provide Medicaid coverage to former foster youth up to age 26 if they were in foster care in the state and enrolled in Medicaid on their 18th birthday. 12 states have taken up the option to extend this coverage to former foster youth from other states as well. Now, looking towards the right side of the slide for pregnant women, you see that nearly half of states, 23, have eliminated the five-year waiting period for lawfully residing immigrant pregnant women, and 15 states cover income-eligible pregnant women regardless of their immigration status through CHIP's unborn child option. And with that, I'll turn it over to Tricia to talk a little bit more about some of the streamlined enrollment and renewal processes.
Thanks, Jess, and hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. I'm going to delve into the enrollment, renewal, and cost-sharing policies, at least the highlights of those that we collect in the report. One of the key goals of the ACA is to move away from paper-driven processes, and you can clearly see that in this slide where we're reporting the number of states offering an online application or a telephone application. What's most important is the progress that's been made. All states except for Tennessee now have an online application, and that's up from 37 states just 2 years ago. In the same period of time, the number of states allowing individuals to apply over the phone has tripled from 15 to 47. In addition to some of the options Jess mentioned about increasing access to coverage, federal rules also allow states to offer several temporary or permanent ways to facilitate enrollment and retention of eligible individuals. These strategies may expedite access to healthcare services, as is the case with presumptive eligibility, which more than half of the states use. Or these strategies may fast-track enrollment or improve retention by relying on data from other programs to identify and enroll or renew eligible individuals. In addition to boosting enrollment, states report reduced administrative costs when options like the Express Lane eligibility or using SNAP data to enroll newly eligible adults are deployed. While all states must establish 12-month renewal periods, states have the option to go one step further and adopt 12-month continuous eligibility. Continuous eligibility helps to reduce churn and can improve the ability to measure healthcare quality by eliminating gaps in coverage. Almost two-thirds of the states now offer 12-month continuous coverage to children in either Medicaid or CHIP. Another key goal of the ACA is to move states toward verifying eligibility through trusted electronic sources of data. States must verify citizenship and immigration status through electronic sources, which include the Social Security Administration and the Department of Homeland Security. States must also verify income through electronic sources, but they have the option to do so prior to enrolling an individual, which 40 states do, or post-enrollment, which has been adopted in 11 states. For other eligibility criteria, states have the flexibility to accept the applicant's attestation or to verify either pre- or post-enrollment. As you can see from this slide, states are more likely to verify age, date of birth, before enrollment, then accept self-attestation. But for state residency and household composition, at least two-thirds of the states accept the applicant's self-attestation unless the state has conflicting information on file. Moving on to take a look at renewals, about two-thirds of the Medicaid agencies and separate CHIP programs delayed renewals for some period of time in 2014 as they prepared for the first round of MAGI-based renewals. About half of those states, 17, report that they will still be processing 2014 renewals in 2015. In this year's survey, it was really tricky to capture a complete up-to-the-minute picture of swiftly evolving processes like renewals because the policy and systems environment continues to rapidly change and improve on a week-to-week basis. Achieving the ACA's highly automated paperless renewal processes has been challenging for states for a number of reasons, including their needing to develop this system capacity and data linkages, transferring data for existing enrollees from their old legacy-based computer systems, and collecting new information to facilitate no-wrong-door access to marketplace subsidies when individuals are determined ineligible for Medicaid or CHIP. Establishing and refining these paperless renewal processes will be a top priority in many states in 2015. When you look at moving to paperless processes and using electronic sources, it's very clear that at the heart of the ACA is the goal to accelerate the use of new high-performing interconnected information technology systems. How states are integrating their systems across coverage options and with other public programs depends on their marketplace structure. States with a state-based marketplace have the option to fully integrate eligibility and enrollment for all their coverage programs into a single system, of which 12 states have done so, like New York, who you will hear from in a few minutes. Two of the state-based exchange states have separate marketplace and Medicaid systems, while three state-based marketplace states use healthcare.gov for eligibility and enrollment. along with the 34 states that are federal marketplace states, all of these Medicaid agencies must maintain a separate system from the marketplace, and they must have an electronic process in place to transfer accounts between programs. While the account transfer process experienced significant challenges during the ACA's first open enrollment period, the process has significantly improved in this second open enrollment period. Deploying these new eligibility systems is very complicated. Doing so in phases can facilitate the process while minimizing the number of bugs and glitches that are inherent in launching any new system. To this end, a number of states that previously operated a multi-benefit eligibility system, that is an integrated system that managed eligibility for medical assistance and other programs such as SNAP or child care subsidies, these states have delinked their Medicaid program from the other assistance groups. Only 19 of the 45 states that previously operated integrated systems continue to determine eligibility for both Medicaid and non-health programs. A dozen states, however, indicate that they plan to phase in other programs in the future. And now that CMS has signaled its intent to extend enhanced funding for systems integration, more states may explore this option in the future. Reflecting on the very low income of enrollees, you can see from this slide that very few states charge premiums or monthly payments in Medicaid. On the other hand, due to the modestly higher income levels in CHIP, 27 of the 36 separate CHIP programs charge premiums. Cost sharing for parents and adults in Medicaid is more common, with 40 states requiring cost sharing of parents, while 20 of the 28 expansion states charge adults cost sharing. About half of the states also assess cost sharing for children, again, mostly in CHIP. So in closing, and looking ahead, I think one of the key takeaways from this report is that the long-standing gap in coverage for adults has been eliminated in the 28 states that expanded Medicaid, but persists in the 23 non-expansion states where parents are covered at a median eligibility of 45% of the federal poverty level. That's less than $9,000 a year for a family of three. And non-disabled adults without dependent children remain ineligible for coverage. To put this in perspective, a single parent in Texas or Alabama with two children cannot get Medicaid if she earns just a little more than $300 a month. States are making meaningful progress in implementing new systems and paperless enrollment processes, but work is ongoing. In the coming year, states will continue to expand and enhance their system functionality, including integrating non-matched by Medicaid and non-health programs into their systems. Key focus for the states in 2015 will be refining their automated renewal processes, widening their use of electronic data sources, and improving seamless coordination between Medicaid or CHIP and the marketplaces. In the year ahead, we'll be keeping an eye on the broader policy environment, which has implications for coverage. These include state decisions to adopt the Medicaid expansion, as well as delivery and payment system reforms. By the end of September, Congress must act to extend funding for CHIP, and any delay could have a significant impact on our country's success in achieving historic low rates of uninsurance among children. And last but not least, there'll be continuing debate over the ACA in the political and legal fields, and those two, including the Supreme Court's consideration of King versus Burwell, could have effect on the progress that we've made.
Great. Thank you so much, Jessica and Tricia. That was a great overview of the survey findings. Again, I would encourage you to take a look at the full survey report for additional details and state-by-state tables if you're interested in seeing policies specific to your state. I will also remind you that if you have any questions, you can feel free to submit them through the chat function as we proceed, and we'll come back to them at the Q&A session at the end. But now I want to turn it over to Vicki Wachino with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to hear some of her perspectives on today's survey findings. Thanks, Vicki.
Thanks, Samantha. And thank you to the entire Kaiser and Georgetown teams for this important work. Every year I look forward to reading the results of this survey because it is such a great marker of our progress at both the federal and state level in simplifying coverage for low-income people. And I think that these year's findings do not disappoint. They are very notable for the progress we have made over the past year in simplifying the enrollment process, the eligibility process, and ultimately in getting people into coverage. As many of you know, we track state progress and our progress in enrolling people in coverage, and we measure against a pre-open enrollment 2013 baseline. So we compare enrollment that took place through this past October 2014, to enrollment levels from before the first open enrollment period in October 2013 started. And we know from that data that over the past year plus, almost 10 million people have gained coverage for Medicaid and CHIP. And I can't think of a better way of demonstrating the success of and the effect of the efforts that states have made in simplifying the process and expanding coverage to low-income people than that. And we should have updated enrollment numbers out shortly. So with that as a start, I'll talk a little bit about kind of where we've come from over the past year, which is really has been a year of enormous progress, and look ahead to the year ahead, where I think more progress to come in many of the areas, especially that Tricia noted. As of today, 27 states and the district, as you heard Jessica say earlier, have expanded Medicaid coverage for low-income adults. In those states, we have seen not only significant gains in coverage, we've also seen a notable impact in the health system, including the costs of uncompensated care. And HHS's Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation did an analysis just looking at the costs of uncompensated care in hospitals post-ACA implementation. And they found that three-quarters of the reduction in uncompensated care accrued to states that have expanded Medicaid, which I think really speaks to the impact that coverage expansion has. Now, like many of you know, we're working actively with states that have not yet taken up the expansion to consider doing so. And we are always open for discussion with additional states who are thinking about it. Turning next to the enrollment process and some of the findings that Tricia identified, I really appreciated the title of Kaiser's report, Modern Era Medicaid and CHIP Eligibility. And I do think that we have crossed the threshold into the modern era. If you look, and many of you on this call have been working on eligibility issues for some time, and recall in 2010 when ACA was first enacted, it clearly established a vision for a simple, streamlined system for Medicaid and CHIP beneficiaries in conjunction with a simple, streamlined system that applied to Marketplace beneficiaries. And I think over the course of 2014, we saw that vision largely realized. As Tricia pointed out, there's widespread use of our single streamlined application, both online and phone application use across states is high. And as the Kaiser data points to, the functionality of those applications is growing. And so increasingly we're seeing states being able to use dynamic online applications, which minimizes the numbers of questions that applicants have to answer in order to get coverage. We've seen states adopting electronic verification, using a range of data sources to verify eligibility in real time. And we see increasing numbers of states making eligibility determinations for the populations whose eligibility is determined using modified adjusted gross income in real time or close to real time, which is a really remarkable sign of progress. Looking ahead to the rest of 2014, it really just started, but we have a lot more to do. I think Tricia highlighted one key area for us, which is the renewal process. We know many Medicaid agencies are conducting administrative renewals or using pre-populated renewal forms, and we expect most states to be using them by the end of 2015. So we're looking forward to working with states on that front. And as Tricia noted, progress on the renewal front is evolving so rapidly that it's hard to keep up with, and our staff is available to work with states as they work on their streamlined renewal process, including using some of the processes that some states use to enroll beneficiaries through a fast-track enrollment process of using SNAP to help enrollment. You can apply the same similar process to renewals, and many states have. Underlying all of the functionality of the systems and the ability to enroll people is the ability of automated systems to accurately and quickly process MAGI determinations. And as Tricia noted in her comments, CMS last October announced that we would extend the availability of the enhanced 90% matching rate for eligibility and enrollment systems that perform essential functions for determining eligibility quickly and in coordination with the marketplace. And we are developing rulemaking to implement that 90-10 match on an ongoing basis, and you can look for that later this year. As we look ahead, I think some of the key fronts we'll continue to work with states on are expanding the use of multi-benefit applications. Tricia forecasted that a number of states will be moving forward with integrated applications this year. And also working intensively with some states on pulling their eligibility systems for their non-MAGI populations into the streamlined process. So much more to come on that. Those conversations are in their early stages with most states. And so I'll just end on the note before we turn it over to the other panelists who'll give you much more of a ground-level perspective on noting that the ability to give people coverage, to offer broad coverage, and to get them enrolled and keep them enrolled is really the underpinning of having strong delivery systems for Medicaid and CHIP beneficiaries. And so another key priority of ours at CMS is working with the states and stakeholders to really become the most effective payers possible and to advance quality of care. So much more to come on that in 2015 and beyond as well. Samantha, I'll turn it back over to you.
Thanks so much, Vicki. That was great, and I think really helped frame the survey findings from the perspectives of CMS. We're now going to turn it over to Judy Arnold in New York to hear about some of her reflections on the survey findings from there. Thanks, Judy.
Thank you, Samantha. Hello, everyone. Kaiser's 50-state survey clearly shows that there have been significant gains in Medicaid eligibility and enrollment, as well as improvements in how consumers apply for coverage as a result of the ACA. And I'm going to give you a snapshot of how this plays in New York. And in New York, we added 500,000 people to Medicaid in 2014. And of these, about 10% were newly eligible. And that was a result that our expansion was actually small because, in a sense, New York's Medicaid expansion consisted primarily of converting a Medicaid waiver population to the new adult group. So that conversion of a waiver population was most of our new adult group population. But we did have some newly eligible, and they were childless adults with incomes between 100 and 133% of poverty. But most of our 500,000 newly enrolled individuals were previously eligible but not enrolled. And many of them came in with looking for tax credits and ended up being Medicaid eligible. The state's eligibility levels for other populations remain largely the same as they were prior to the ACA. And New York operates a fully integrated eligibility system for MAGI Medicaid population, CHIP, and QHP coverage with real-time eligibility determinations. And in 1 year, we have successfully reduced paper applications to less than 1% of all applications, and this from a state that was almost exclusively paper prior to our new system. Most individuals apply online with an assister or by phone, and most also upload verification documents electronically. Families apply on one application and receive tailored eligibility determinations. What that means is a family can enter all their information into the online application and receive eligibility results for each member of the family, even if the individuals are eligible for separate programs. In New York, most families have mixed eligibility given the high level of our CHIP program. Most adults receiving tax credits have children in CHIP. We also have families with members eligible for Medicaid, CHIP, and QHPs, and being able to apply as a family without referrals to other programs has improved the user experience. After families receive their eligibility determination, they can go on to select a plan for each member of the family, even if the members are eligible for different programs. Families then receive integrated eligibility notices and enrollment notices, a major improvement from the past when family members might receive a separate notice for each person and certainly separate notices by program. Integration allows families to move seamlessly between programs if circumstances change and at renewal. If families report changes in income, they can update their application and move to either Medicaid, CHIP, or QHP coverage without a gap and often in the same health plan. In October, we launched administrative renewal, whereby we can use the electronic verification sources to renew individuals and provide them an opportunity to make changes. While we don't yet have data on the percent that administratively renewed without taking any action versus those who return to update their information, anecdotal evidence suggests that many people return to update their information, as the electronic sources, particularly for income, are not as current as we would all like. 2013 and 14 were incredibly challenging years in terms of getting the system up and running, and we faced and continue to face some key challenges. And among them are the electronic verification of immigration status through the VLP service has been extraordinarily challenging for us, and we still continue to work with CMS on resolving some of our issues there. Implementing system changes to keep up with changing federal guidance has also been a challenge, and moving the volume in our legacy system to the new eligibility system. But I would say our greatest challenge has been in embracing integration itself. While New York fully embraced the ACA's vision of fully integrated automated eligibility determinations, siloed federal rule development and increased rule complexity in lieu of the hope for meaningful simplification and streamlining has unfortunately resulted in significant barriers to integration and increased system development costs. And looking ahead, we are focused on completing our system development and making improvements to the user experience, as well as adding the non-MAGI Medicaid population into the new system. Thank you, and we'll answer questions later.
Thanks, Judy. It's great to hear all about the progress and achievements in New York. And now we're going to turn it over to Rex Plouffe from Ohio, to hear some perspectives on their experience there.
Thank you, and thanks for the opportunity to share Ohio's story with all of you today. It's interesting, as I listened to the conversation, the presentation, as we got this far along, and that much of what I've heard really reflects, I think, what we've experienced and achieved here in Ohio, and I think you'll see that here as I go through the slide. One thing I'd like to say is Ohio is kind of heading down a path of replacing a 30-year-old legacy system, an old COBOL system that many states probably are heading down the same path. But we're heading down a path of an enterprise eligibility platform that we intend to go beyond just Medicaid, SNAP, and TANF. And you'll see that we intend to put many other income-based human services programs on this eligibility platform, so that we can get a holistic view of what our citizens need, what services they're using, and then use that data to drive better policy decisions in the state. So looking back since our initiation of this program, and we call this the Ohio Benefits program, we were kind of a late state to get started, but launched our system in 2013, in August of 2013. And since that point in time, we've had 1.4 million Ohioans apply for benefits through the new system. What I think is really interesting is that we've had over 60% of those applications got initiated via a self-service portal. Ohio never had really a functional self-service portal prior to this initiative, and we've been able to, in this short period of time, drive 60% of our folks to an online process. Many of these cases have been worked, so 90% of the cases have already been processed. We've been able to, and I've heard the other folks talk about this, we've been able to convert over 1.5 million individuals the case data from our legacy system. And this is critical to, you know, a foundation of transferring to a modern platform is to be able to get that key data out of your legacy system and into your new system. We've heard many times, I think, already today about the pace of change. And this, I think, is what one of the things that reflects in Ohio's case. Since going live in October 2013, we have had over 20 major upgrades to our system. So what we tried to do is to get functionality out there as quickly as we can and keep adding to it and keep improving on the system. But there are challenges, obviously. And this first bullet point, I think I kind of stated what I really wanted to say here. And we have struggled with authenticating individuals and not necessarily their citizenship status, but if we have Bob Smith apply via the self-service portal, we're really having a struggle trying to identify which Bob Smith this is, or if we can identify Bob Smith and his family uniquely. And when we fail to do that, we obviously can't verify data, but it also means the application and the processing of the application falls out and becomes a manual process. Verifying data for us has been a challenge, in particular the income data. We're finding much of the data that we have citizens submitting does not match with the IRS data that we check with via the federal hub. And so then again, this creates another another manual process for us to contact those individuals and verify their income. And notice of actions, or NOAs, just has been a limited functionality for us. I think it's a combination of our state policy and disconnects with our system functionality. And this NOAA limitation really limiting our ability to drive county shared services, which is something I'll kind of talk about, is something we see in the future. But we have a strong vision of where we want to go. And in the next 18 months to 2 years, we plan to make significant progress. So we'll get the age blind and disabled Medicaid population onto the new platform, as well as getting SNAP and TANF. And those design sessions are well underway, and much of that work will be done within the next 12 months. We want to really enhance data, the electronic verification of data, and move away from paper. And I noted New York's success in this, and we'll probably be reaching out to them. But we have a heavy county workforce, and really want to drive the paper out of the system to free those folks up to work on more complex cases. We want to drive to county shared services so that when one county has a high influx of applications, that any county can pick those applications up and work them, or if there was a disaster in one county, that another county can work cases. So we have a large state initiative and working well with our county partners to drive towards county shared services in Ohio. And then lastly, we've begun work and plan to move WIC and child care onto the Ohio platform within the next few years, and that'll be the next big progress for us to move this beyond just Medicaid, SNAP, and TANF and have a very broad enterprise application for human services benefits eligibility. So with that, I'll turn it back over.
Thanks so much, Rex. And next, we're going to hear from Linda Nablo in Virginia, who will be our last speaker on today's panel. I would also encourage you to get your questions in via chat. We are going to turn to the Q&A after we hear from Linda. So look forward to your remarks and perspectives from Virginia. Take it away.
Thank you, Samantha. This is Linda. First, again, thank you to Kaiser for producing this report, as I read through it in preparation for this, the advanced copy, it very much depicts what's been happening in Virginia and I'm sure other states as well. So it's a very accurate reflection of what we've been experiencing and where we're headed. So Virginia is unfortunately a little different from New York and Ohio in that we have not yet expanded Medicaid. We are on all those charts. You will notice that Virginia covers children and pregnant women essentially to 200% of poverty and parents only up to about 45% of poverty, and we do not cover childless adults in the current Medicaid program. We are an assessment state with FFM as opposed to a determination state, which has some challenges to it. We did, prior to the ACA, we did have online and telephonic applications for our children's programs, and we have built on that to come into compliance with ACA. We did adopt early MAGI to get started on all of this. In terms of key challenges, just like the other states, even though we didn't expand Medicaid, we certainly had many system development challenges on our hands and still do. We, too, are building an integrated system integrated with other human services programs. The plan at this point is in late 2015 to bring the non-MAGI Medicaid population into the same system. Child care is already there, and then following that will be SNAP, TANF, and whatever else can fit in there. And I just have to say that I think that kind of an integrated system, while it's a very worthy goal, certainly presents many of its own challenges, everything from the different federal rules governing the different programs to the intense coordination that is required amongst the human service agencies. And in our case, it's not the Medicaid agency that is administering the new development of the new system. So there are challenges all along the way with that, although I suppose when we get to the end, it's going to be a very good thing for the citizens of the Commonwealth. We've had challenges with migrating the cases out of the old legacy system. We were finally able to migrate all the MAGI Medicaid cases by the end of October, so we're happy with that. There have been many releases. I didn't count them up like Ohio did, but it's probably approaching that number in Virginia. At this point, there's about monthly to implement fixes, tweaks, and significant enhancements as well. We certainly got the MAGI rules in on time, in fact, early to implement early MAGI, but there's a lengthy list of things that need to be improved to the system. I just spent this morning in a two-hour meeting going through at least a partial list of those. I also have to say that I think a significant challenge for Virginia, even without expansion, was training for local workers. There were, as we all know, brand new rules and a brand new system. And anybody who's ever implemented a brand new system knows that it comes with many difficulties and problems initially as people get used to using it. So it was a huge challenge for local departments of social services. There are probably almost 4,000 eligibility workers spread across the Commonwealth of Virginia, and many of them deal in the Medicaid program at least partially. And so learning the new MAGI rules as well as a new system to implement those rules was a significant hurdle to overcome. And then I have to say a big challenge for Virginia was application volume, even though we didn't expand Medicaid. Some describe it as our pseudo-expansion, meaning we did all the work, but unfortunately we didn't gain any real coverage expansion through it. We are bordered by D.C., Maryland, West Virginia, states that have all expanded Medicaid. And, of course, in addition, last October, October 2013, there was a great deal of publicity about the opportunities for individuals to get coverage. And so we, like states that did expand, were flooded with applications and weren't prepared for it, being a non-expansion state. In fact, from the first year, from October 1, 2013 through September 30th, 2014, there was a 43% increase in front door applications that flooded into local departments of social services. In fact, in that first 9 month period, it was a 62% increase. And again, I would say we were unprepared for that volume to hit us. In addition to that, of course, there are the FFM account transfers, and Virginia has in 2014, or from the beginning of open enrollment in 2013 through the end of that first period, we got 62,000 account transfers to deal with as well. So that was a very big challenge for us to deal with here. That resulted in a significant backlog, certainly of the FFM applications, but also an unacceptably high number of front door applications that were out of compliance with 45 days, and a growing number of overdue renewals as well. We are pulling ourselves out of that. We have made tremendous headway with the FFM applications, although not completely out of the woods there. The challenge between focusing on timely processing of applications, when we seem to attack that, it tends to up the number of overdue renewals, and when we focus attention on getting rid of the overdue renewals, we tend to get delayed processing of applications. So I would say we are not yet in balance in Virginia with meeting the challenge of all these applications. Looking ahead, in addition to some of the issues that we're concerned about, that the whole nation is concerned about, such as the funding for CHIP and the coming Supreme Court decision, we, in Virginia, one of our primary strategies to address the application volume was to create a centralized processing center for, certainly at first, at least, the FFM applications. So we have created a central unit so that the local departments of social services do not even see the FFM applications. And that unit began in mid-August and has processed so far about 47,000 applications in a fairly short amount of time. The plan is for that unit to be able to take some of the more straightforward and simplified Medicaid applications coming in online and telephonically in the future as well, and leave the more complex multi-benefit applications for the local departments of social services. We understand we also have a new governor this year. We switched from Republican to Democratic governor. And so this year we are trying to do a better job of messaging to the citizens of Virginia. More navigators, more application assisters. Virginia did very little of that in preparation for the 2013 open enrollment. Again, a laundry list of continued system enhancements, budget requests in for both more local eligibility workers as well as continued funding for that central processing unit that I talked about. All in all, I would say we too here in Virginia have made great strides in modernization. We are working to improve our electronic verifications, to increase the level of what we call no-touch applications, which I think probably equates to real-time or near-real-time determinations. There are user-friendly client accounts for changes and renewals and checking on status, et cetera. So we have made, I think, really big strides, like all states, in modernization, but still have a ways to go. And for us, expansion is still an open question. We have a governor who is passionately committed to expansion and a legislature that's not so much. So we still deal month by month with trying to build a system and capacity that could quickly and easily move to expansion should we get that opportunity going forward. So I think that's all I have to say. Samantha, back to you.
Thanks, Linda. That was great, and I think your remarks really clearly illustrate that even in a state that has not adopted the Medicaid expansion, you've made significant changes and been implementing a lot of upgrades to your system as a result of the ACA. So we're now going to turn it over to questions and answers. Again, you can submit questions through the chat function on your screen, and we are going to do our best to get through as many of them as possible. I want to start with a question for Jessica. Thinking about non-expansion states and children aging out of Medicaid or CHIP in those non-expansion states, since the eligibility levels are much higher, what are the coverage options as folks become young adults in those states if they're above those low Medicaid eligibility levels?
Sure. So as children age out of coverage as children, they essentially become adults, and the coverage options that are available to them are the same that would be available for other adults in the state. So in states that have adopted the Medicaid expansion, children with young adults with income below those Medicaid expansion limits, so 138% of the federal poverty in most states, continue to be eligible for Medicaid. For those with incomes above those limits, there remain options for them to obtain coverage through the marketplace, and they are eligible for tax subsidies to obtain coverage, to purchase private coverage in the marketplace, if they have incomes up to 400% of the federal poverty level. In states that have not expanded Medicaid, there is a slightly different situation. If they have income, if they are parents or fall into some other category where they meet the often low limits, they may still be eligible for Medicaid. If they're childless adults and don't have another source of coverage that is through an employer, for example, and they do not have income above the federal poverty level, many of them may fall into what we describe as a coverage gap, and resources are available on the Kaiser website with more information, but essentially in states that have not expanded Medicaid, for young adults or others who have income above the low Medicaid eligibility limits and below the federal poverty level, they are ineligible for coverage and will likely remain uninsured. Many of these individuals, if they have income above those limits, may also still continue to be eligible for financial assistance to obtain coverage through the marketplace.
I think we should also add that that is a group that qualifies for buying catastrophic coverage in the marketplace, which would be a high deductible plan, but given the purchasing power of the marketplace, the cost of those policies would be less than they were pre-ACA, even though the coverage isn't great, it provides at least some protection against injury or illness.
Sticking with some eligibility-related questions, Vicki, maybe you can address this one. What is the CMS eligibility policy for non-citizens under the President's recent executive action?
I assume that the question is referring to the executive action taken late last year with respect to people coming to the United States, and the policy was generally that people who fall into that category under the executive order are not eligible for health coverage.
Thanks for that clarification, Vicki. Now for our state partners on the line, maybe you each spoke about many of the advancements that have been achieved in your enrollment processing through your new systems and upgrades. Have any of you tracked how the time to enroll a person has changed pre-ACA versus today? Go ahead, Rex.
Sure. This is Rex of Ohio. It's been very hard for us to track that because under the legacy system, it was very hard to track timeliness, as well as it was hard to distinguish a Medicaid case from a SNAP and TANF case. So it's nearly impossible for us to compare the two systems side by side. However, we do know that, well over 90% of our cases have been worked to date, which really kind of tells me that, that our county workers are doing a great job of keeping up with the tremendous amount of work, and increased caseload that we've seen, since the ACA and going live with Medicaid expansion in 2014.
Linda or Judy, do you have any perspectives on how enrollment time may have shifted as a result of the ACA?
This is Judy in New York. We know that it's shortened. We don't have pre-post data as requested. I mean, we know a lot of our applicants get done in less than a day. They get a determination online. The closest we've been able to look at it is if somebody owes income documents for Medicaid, we pen them for 15 days to provide the income documents. And about 85% of our enrollees are not pended, which means that 85% are getting through in a day. And the pended ones are pended, and we don't have good timeline information, but we still believe it's well below 45 days.
And this is Linda. I would say we too don't have the metrics that really measure pre and post. We're nowhere near New York in the percent that are getting through that quickly, which is why I'll probably be calling Judy too after this phone call. just all I can say is that at least a percentage of applications are moving through with nobody having to touch them or do anything to them, and very quickly. We didn't have that at all before the ACA, and we're working hard to increase that percentage every month.
Rex, we've gotten a couple questions in about the county shared service program that you mentioned in your remarks. Can you talk a little bit about what you're envisioning for this program besides balancing application volume, and also a little bit about the funding for the upgrades at the county level?
Sure. So relative to the vision of what shared services is, goes well beyond the concept of just processing a case for another county. And what we really want to get to is a consistent process and a consistent expectation for the citizens, because in Ohio it has been kind of the history that one county will do work in one manner, and in the county right next door it will be a completely different process. Also, what we see is that in Ohio, and I assume many other states, you may reside in one county but work in another county, and it might be much more advantageous to you as a citizen, especially if you're working, to apply for coverage in the county where you work versus the county where you live. And so moving towards shared services really provides that value and a better experience for the citizens, and provides consistent work processes across counties. And we're trying to leverage and take best practices from one county and move those to others, so that the counties can learn and adopt things that work from their from other counties. Relative to the funding, Dustin here had asked about what is called the local government innovation funding in the state of Ohio. There has been a group of counties in Northeast Ohio that got innovation funding from the state, and this is the funding that the governor has set up to encourage local governments to innovate and move toward shared services. And we have 23 counties in Northeast Ohio who got this innovation money and is using that to do to pull themselves together, and they are looking to function as kind of a single county, and will be kind of one of our first group of folks onto the shared services platform as it goes live later this year. So there has been kind of additional funds that the state has provided to counties to help them during this transition period, especially while we roll out a new system and counties are using both a new and the legacy system until such time that we can get SNAP and TANF onto the new platform.
Thanks, Rex. Maybe, Judy, you can take this next one, since it sounds like you've really had the significant success in achieving highly automated enrollments. Can you speak to how moving towards more automated enrollments and eventually renewals may impact consumers' choice of plans, and how you continue to assure that consumers make an active choice of health plans?
I mean, there are several ways. One is when you move on, so let's say you get Medicaid eligibility determination and you're ready to move on to select a plan, you're offered the full choice of plans, and you can, we have some filters so people can filter, they can search by their provider to get the plans that their providers are in. So there's full electronic functionality for helping you choose electronically. But if you don't choose to do that, we also have an enrollment broker, which can help you select a plan, as we've always had, and that number is available right on to consumers. I believe it's on the screen. And you can also go to an assister for help also if you're not able to choose based on the online tools. So, you know, no one is just given a couple of plans. They're given the full choice of Medicaid plans they can select from.
Linda, there's a question asking about funding for the additional workers and systems enhancements associated with your ACA implementation? What were the key funding sources you relied on there, and how has your spending been impacted by changing enrollment in the state?
Well, first let me explain that we really haven't changed a lot in enrollment because although we had this enormous volume of applications to process, unfortunately, since we didn't expand Medicaid and the eligibility levels remained the same as pre-ACA, the only real significant bump we saw in enrollment was into the family planning waiver, which does have a threshold of 200% FPL. So many of the individuals who were seeking full coverage were only eligible for the family planning waiver. So we didn't really experience the woodwork effect of an increased enrollment. We just processed the applications and a large volume ended up denied. But we, the funding, the 90-10 funding for systems and the enhanced funding for eligibility work is not, fortunately for us, is not tied to expansion. So all states had access to that increased funding, and Virginia, like the others, made full use of that funding. So our system enhancements, we really haven't increased local eligibility staff. We did, when I said we established the centralized processing, we did tap into some system money and some enhanced funding for eligibility work that's available to all states, regardless of their expansion status. How is our spending trending? Way up. I think all states are, if you're talking about combined federal and state funding, I think all states are very aggressively using that 90-10 systems funding and the 75-25 eligibility funding that's available to them. We wouldn't be getting the work done without it.
Well, and also that 75% funding was extended to eligibility workers who are doing the work in the system. Previously, those workers would have qualified only for a 50% administrative match from the federal government. So there definitely are federal resources beyond the systems investment that are helping states to stretch their dollars more in terms of their actual eligibility staff.
Thanks so much. So, Vicki, maybe you can speak a little to this. So as we have increased enrollment within Medicaid, what initiatives and work is underway to help work with physicians and medical providers to meet the needs of the increased number of enrollees in the program?
Sure. Thanks, Samantha. I'll just tag on to what Tricia just said before I answer that question, is that anyone who's interested in learning more about the availability of the enhanced 75% match for eligibility workers can go to our website, Medicaid.gov, and we've got guidance that lays out what qualifies. But Tricia's absolutely right in her assessment that there's help available from the federal level for eligibility workers. You know, I think there are a number of ways that we are working, Samantha, to your question of helping to better connect people to care as they get enrolled. As many of you know, we have been working extensively with states to develop models of care that support integrated health homes for individuals. We are working on, you know, major delivery system reform initiatives around a number of areas, including helping to improve the provision of care around substance use disorder, as well as other areas. So there's a number of ways that as people come into the system, we are working with states, and I'd imagine there's a lot more going on in the state levels, including potentially with the states that are on the call, of really helping to provide coordinated care to people as they enroll in coverage.
Thanks, Vicki. And I'll throw another one at you, which is from the national perspective, do you have a sense of who some of our hard-to-reach enrollees are that are left out there to try and connect with and get enrolled in the program, and what strategies are being deployed to try and reach those folks? And then I'd also ask each of our state level panelists if they have thoughts on who their hard-to-reach groups are in the states and what they're working on to that regard. So, Vicki, do you want to start on that?
I can start, but I think I would probably defer to the states with their closer ground level perspective. The populations that occur as needing special, attention as we accelerate our efforts at eligibility enrollment are clearly around, people who have limited English proficiency, and wanting to make sure that they get into the system as quickly as possible, as well as potentially populations who are homeless. But why don't I turn it over to Rex and Linda and Judy and see what they're seeing in their states.
Rex, do you want to get us started on that?
Sure. I think we've been kind of inundated with increased applications, and so I can't say we've had a real focus on who's been hard to or underrepresented in the enrollment process. But I think the one comment that was just made that struck me is the homeless population and trying to put an address in the system and get them enrolled has been kind of a struggle. But we've come up with some statewide processes to deal with getting the homeless folks enrolled properly. But other than that, I can't really think of a group that has struggled to get enrolled that we're aware of.
Judy, do you have any insights from your experiences in New York?
Yeah, I mean, I would echo what Rex said, and then I would just add that we've always had a big sister component in New York, where sisters with multilingual ability were a big presence in helping people enroll for Medicaid and CHIP, and those have been expanded under the ACA, and a lot of our applications do come from the sisters, so community-based organizations that work with these populations, and we've been doing that for a long time. I can't think of, I mean, we also are dealing with large volumes of applications, and we did have an early effort on the homeless around the address as ID proofing's been an issue, and how to get people ID proofed that may have problems, and we've worked that through with manual processes. So, I think our sisters play our biggest role in helping the hard to reach.
So one question is whether there's anything that healthcare companies, which I'm assuming is referring to managed care plans, can do to help facilitate sort of the new modern enrollment process in Medicaid. Is there anything that any of the healthcare plans in your states are doing that is really helping to smooth enrollment? Any thoughts from me?
This is Linda.
Go ahead, Linda.
I would say I think the health plans we're a heavily managed care state, and I think the health plans can play a very valuable role, especially when it comes to renewal, to learn about the different avenues for renewal and the policies around renewal, and help us educate their members for how to facilitate the renewal process to the greatest extent possible. I think that's a very valuable role they can play.
Judy, so there's been a lot of admiration of the levels of integration and capabilities that you all have achieved in New York. Can you speak a little bit about how you built that system? Was that something that you all built in-house, and really what you saw as the keys that helped make creation of that system so successful to date?
Good question. It's mostly a custom system, and we started with a platform of HCentive, but HCentive, as anyone of the other states that have used it as a platform for plan selection and account creation, it did not have eligibility rules. So for the whole thing that I was focused on, which is the eligibility rules in the new system, that was all custom. And we embraced integration and tried to, from the beginning, I mean, we had the two challenges. One is integration when the rules were coming out after we were building and subsequent to building, and that's just the world we all lived in, and CMS did the best they could, but it's the world we continue to live in, which is building things and then seeing the rules later and going, ooh, maybe not. So So, I think the one major key to our success was phasing in the operations of our system to just in time. So we focused on what did we need by October 2013, what did we need by January, and we really focused on achieving that. The difficulty where we sit now is we were able to open and successfully take apps and have integration, but it's been challenging to continue to add. And sometimes adding to the system means reworking stuff that was before it. And, you know, we all would have liked a lot more time to maybe have done more in the initial opening than we were able to do with a phased-in approach. So the phased-in approach was a key to our success, but it has also created challenges from where we sit right now.
Tricia, so in your remarks, you noted the timeline for CHIP funding. Can you just remind us a little bit about what the future holds for CHIP and some of the implications to consider based on the survey findings we see here today?
Well, CHIP was last reauthorized in 2009 with funding provided for 4 years. And when the ACA passed, it extended funding for 2 additional years. What doesn't line up is a protection within the ACA that requires states to hold steady on their eligibility levels for children through 2019. So technically CHIP does not have to be, quote, reauthorized, but there will be no federal funding after September of 2015 of this year unless Congress acts to extend that funding. We know that there are active conversations going on Capitol Hill. But as yet, there's no specific bill that's moving forward, and it sort of remains to be seen as how quickly Congress will act.
Vicki, one thing you picked up on your remarks, and I think that Tricia also highlighted in the survey findings, was the focus on renewal strategies moving forward. Can you speak to some of the, I know you mentioned that there are some strategies available to states to take up to help facilitate renewals moving forward. Can you talk a little bit about those?
Sure. I think overall we've seen a lot of progress on the renewal front, and I think Tricia's data speaks well to the number of states that, you know, this time last year, even just a few months ago, had delayed renewals and are now starting to work through them. One strategy that we've worked with some states to effectuate in order to quickly process those renewals and keep people enrolled in coverage is the ability to use data, particularly from the SNAP program, to verify people's current income. So that they can keep people enrolled in coverage. So that's just one prominent way that we've used to try to support continuous coverage for people in states as they work to strengthen their renewal process.
So I think we're going to start wrapping up in the next few minutes. I wanted to give each of our speakers an opportunity to add any final comments or thoughts that they want to share. I'll start here with Tricia and Jessica just to see if they have any closing comments.
Well, it's really exciting to watch the work that's going on in the states. Not that the ACA created anything new under the sun, but the fact that between the funding for systems and some of the rules changes, it really is accelerating that modernization of Medicaid and CHIP programs around the country. I also want to add that my favorite data point, which Jeff got to present, is the fact that back 2 years ago, there were 38 states that required that children be uninsured for a period of time before being enrolled in CHIP coverage, recognizing that the goal of the ACA is to provide ready access to coverage universally. Really pleased to see that count is down to 18.
And the only thing I guess I would add is to echo what Samantha said in the beginning, which is that I would encourage everybody to take a look at the report because we did present these findings at a relatively high level, and there's information for each state on a number of the topics that we discussed today, including some additional data points that you may be interested in.
Okay. Vicki, any closing comments from you?
I don't think I have any key themes, but I'll just say that as I listened to Rex and Judy and Linda describe the challenges that they face with their systems, with processing any backlogs, with balancing trade-offs between things like renewals and incoming applications. Every single thing on their list resonated with me as an area that we're hearing not just from those states but from many states. So I think they did a great job of articulating the challenges ahead. So as far as we've come, we still have work to do, and I think you heard from three terrific states about what the path forward entails.
Judy, any thoughts from your end in New York?
Well, just to echo what Vicki said, and we certainly still have work to do, but it's useful to get this kind of 50-state snapshot to take an appreciation for how far we've come in this last year. And sometimes when we're in the states dealing with our daily issues, it's hard to sort of step back and have that perspective. So I thank you for that.
Great. Rex, your thoughts?
I'd just like to thank, Kaiser Family Foundation for the opportunity and for the valuable data in the report, and also for pulling the states together. I find that every time I talk to another state, I learn more than I think I probably share, and I appreciate the opportunity to connect with our other state partners.
And last but not least, Linda, your thoughts from Virginia.
Well, Ohio and New York kind of stole my thoughts, but I would reiterate that it's good to take a minute and stop and think about how far we have come, even in a non-expansion state, because day by day we are still very much in the throes of trying to change this program and modernize this program. I look forward to, 2, 3, 4, 5 years from now being able to look back and sort of tell the old stories of what it used to be like in Medicaid, because we're not there anymore. And just, Tricia, I would like to echo what Tricia said. If you can get rid of a waiting period and CHIP in a conservative state like Virginia, you can do it in the rest of those states, too. So good luck.
So I think as we see in the report and hear from the remarks today, we really see that there has been major advancement and progress achieved in this past year with implementation of the ACA. We're so thankful for all our panelists for joining us here today and giving us some perspectives on the data findings that are in the report. I would encourage you, as Jessica mentioned, to go take a look at the full report on our website. And also we'll note that a recording of this briefing will be available on the website later this week, as well as a copy of the slides available for download. Thank you all for sharing your time with us today. We hope that you found this briefing informative and look forward to you joining us at an upcoming event sometime soon. Take care and have a great day.